The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
When the state of New Hampshire submitted a bid to Amazon, you remember, throwing Londonderry into the ring as home for the company's second headquarters, they summed up their case like this: all the benefits of Boston without all the headaches. It may not have been the wisest PR strategy for the state, but it is something that comes up a lot when you ask people what they like best about living in New Hampshire. They'll tell you, you're only an hour from the mountains, an hour from the ocean, and an hour from Boston. Unless you live in Pittsburgh, that is, New Hampshire's northernmost town. If the state is shaped vaguely like one of those foam hands that you get at a baseball game, Pittsburgh is located at the tip of the index finger.
Actually, the closest city to Pittsburgh is Sherbrooke, Quebec.
This is Chantel Carney, who's been working at the Bear Tree Resort in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, for nearly a decade. Producer Taylor Quimby called her up.
Do you ever go there?
I haven't for a very long time. I'm older now, so my partying days are over.
Sherbrooke, Quebec, home to some 160,000 people, 2.5 times the size of Portland, Maine.
But that's definitely, yeah, that's the closest city. It's about 1.5 hours away.
As opposed to what, Boston or Portland, which is what, 2.5?
Boston, you're looking at almost 4.
Whew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're 13 miles from the Canadian border at the top of New Hampshire.
Ici, c'était ça, la vie.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Right now, NHPR is putting out a series called The Balance, stories that look at the cost of living in New Hampshire. And today we're spending some of the show looking at arts and culture north of the Notches and how some folks are trying to build communities that don't need to advertise their proximity to Boston or Quebec.
Before you record anything, there is no nightlife. Yeah, it's like, don't waste your tape.
Cost of living is a concept that's not only defined by how much money you make or how much you pay for rent. It's a complicated equation of what is valued, and the pros and cons of a particular place are weighed against one another. In New Hampshire's Great North Woods, rents may be cheaper, but so are the wages. And if you want to catch some music, you can expect to do some driving.
There's more dining establishments in Pittsburgh than there are in Colebrook, so we have that. But to say there's nightlife per se, no, none.
Back when baby boomers were coming of age and when the Ethan Allen furniture plant across the river in Beecher Falls was still in operation, Chantel says the Pittsburgh area had a lot more going on.
There was a band somewhere every weekend, at least one to maybe 3 or 4 bands every weekend, and now there's nothing. And honestly, if somebody was actually to bring, you know, have a hot spot like that, like, you know, with the younger generation, it will bring out a little bit of your older generation because they're not all dead. You know, they still want to have something to do.
If you ask Charlie Jordan, though, the North Country music scene is more vibrant than ever.
Last Saturday when we had this group Rock On, you know, here we are on a January night in northern New Hampshire, and the place was packed, you know, and people just came in, and I mean, there were some snowmobilers, like, wow, where am I?
Charlie is editor at the Colebrook Chronicle and president of the Great North Woods Committee for the Arts. That committee was formed in May of 2003. Coincidentally, their first meeting was on the actual day that the old man fell from Cannon Mountain. Since then, the committee has helped set up some 500 shows at different venues all around the North Country, many of them lured from over the border.
Here we are. I'll tell them, you know, you want to get a foot in the United States, we can get a toe into the United States by coming to Colebrook. And before you know it, we have a major headliner appearing in Colebrook. And it's been really fun.
By major headliner, Charlie doesn't mean Beyonce or Bieber, but he has booked Enya's sister, Moya Brennan. And right now, the committee is talking to James McCartney about doing a gig. That's Paul McCartney's son.
Looking out and it's getting light.
One thing is for sure, in small towns and rural areas, if you want more art, more music, more anything, you just have to go out there and create it. Charlie, who also plays in a Celtic band with his wife and grown-up son, knows that lesson well.
This whole phenomenon that's happening with us lives and dies by this committee, you know? The fact is that if all of a sudden we just stopped, people would reminisce and they'd say, oh, yeah, I remember those days. You know, when you have a structure, when you set something up, like the McDowell Colony is down in Peterborough or something like that, once you get something that goes beyond individuals, then it outlives the group.
Which is why Charlie and his committee are working to set up the Great Northwood Center for the Arts, a permanent arts campus with workshops and concerts just outside of Colebrook. Back in Pittsburgh, there are signs of a shift.
Let me see if I can't find their number for you.
Not long ago, a pair of snowmobile-loving brothers moved from Boston to open a restaurant called The Berg.
It's a very cool spot. You know, they have a lot of microbrews. Their menu's really eclectic. It's very cool.
I am John Hamilton, chef, co-owner of The Berg, Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. You know, we still have simple stuff on the menu, but like doing a blueberry pizza has been probably the biggest hit we've had so far.
That is 30-year-old John Hamilton. After throwing a New Year's party at The Berg, complete with band, he's thinking, why not keep it up?
We plan on like once or twice a month having them play upstairs because we have a full lounge upstairs. It's weird. And now I feel old. I do like antiquing. I'm like, what the hell am I doing with my life right now? I went from the clubs of Boston to the antiques of northern New Hampshire. But you definitely have to figure out your niche and your own fun up here.
And if he ever misses Boston, there's always Sherbrooke, just 50 miles away.
Yeah, Sherbrooke is a fun little college town. I mean, definitely a younger crowd, which was nice.
It's no secret that New Hampshire is aging and that attracting young professionals is essential for the state's future. NHPR's Lauren Chulgen visited a town an hour and a half south from Pittsburgh, which may serve as a case study for making small-town life a little more attractive to 20- and 30-somethings. She reported back for our Cost of Living series, The Balance.
When I first explored Littleton's quaint Main Street, I did not expect to find a guy like Joel Starella.
This is a pretty rare piece that I just picked up.
Littleton is known for being home to the world's longest candy counter and the author of Pollyanna.
And it has Polo USA stitched in big red letters.
Vintage Ralph Lauren sweatshirts or highlighter-colored ski suits, not so much. And those are just two of the gems you can find at Starella's cash-only vintage. The store is an impeccably organized trove of 80s and 90s treasures. There's a neon champion logo on the wall and a framed photo of Michael Jordan flying toward a slam dunk. If you haven't heard, the 90s are back.
If you have someone from New York that's just here for a wedding or whatever, exploring, they're totally caught off guard that this would be here. And everyone says, oh, you know, this would do so well if it was in X city, whatever city. But I think that it's doing so well because it's here.
Littleton falls between the Vermont border and the White Mountains, about an hour from Concord. Starella used to live in Boston. He worked at the luxury accessory boutique Hermes and later made hand-stitched leather bags that sold for five and six figures. But just over a year ago, he thought maybe it's time to move back home.
It's just, you know, it's kind of like this calming feeling. You drive through the notch and it does feel like, you know, like a belonging.
Joel Starella is like the most sought-after quantity in New Hampshire right now. In many towns, especially in mostly rural areas, the aging population is growing rapidly, and the number of school-aged kids is declining. Littleton is one of those places. But lately, it seems to have figured out a way to attract new people that could help turn the tide. There isn't any data on just how many young business owners are in Littleton or surrounding towns, but anecdotally, the list is long. It includes a bakery, a brewery, a tattoo shop, multiple new bed and breakfasts, and much more. So what is going on up there?
Hi, are you Jessica.
I am.
I'm Lauren. Nice to meet you.
I visited Jessica Bunker at the Littleton Area Chamber of Commerce, and together we came up with four big factors that have contributed to the area's recent growth.
The question always is, what's the secret sauce up here? You know, there's a buzz, there's this vibrancy that's coming in. And the big secret, I think, it's out. It's the people up here.
I know. Cheesy, right? Compounded by the fact that just across the street from us is an eternally smiling Pollyanna statue, it's almost over the top. But this strong community bond theory checks out. Just ask Joel Starella.
I was amazed all the neighboring stores. I would say everyone, every shop owner came and introduced themselves. People come in that they say, oh, is this an X store? And they told them to come in and check you out. And that, you know, that means a lot.
Now, this town is by no means perfect. Opioid addiction is a big problem, and while some parents spend hundreds of dollars on their kids' ski team gear, others can't afford Girl Scout uniforms. But there are a lot of people putting in extra hours in hopes that Littleton and the towns around it will succeed. It's one of the reasons Rusty Talbot decided to uproot his family from Washington, D.C. and open a climbing gym here. He loved the tight-knit feel. Another big reason he chose the Littleton area, and point two for our story, there's a lot of stuff to do around here, like hiking, ice climbing, mountain biking, and if you're really adventurous.
I know people who can go down to the seacoast and be surfing in the morning, and then be skiing in the afternoon, and then be fat biking by headlamp in the middle of the night, you know? And that ability that we've got, this huge range of activities in such a compact area, is really unique.
There's also a growing art scene around here, and Littleton isn't totally isolated. It's right off 93, making it easier to access cities like Boston, Burlington, or Montreal. So if transplants need an urban fix, they can get it. Okay, so far we've identified two factors regarding Littleton's recent growth: a tight-knit, engaged community, and access to fun stuff. The third factor is maybe an obvious one. It's relatively cheap to live and work here. Local realtors tell me commercial rent here is nearly half what it would cost for a similar space in Portsmouth or Hanover. Littleton also offers lower energy costs because it has its own water and electricity company. And lower costs mean it's easier for business owners like Joel Starella to not only start up, but to take risks.
That's kind of where I'm always at, is what's the next thing. So my goal is to expand, to get more space, and kind of offer more of a lifestyle aspect than just clothing.
And this brings us to the final factor on our list of why Littleton is growing: a diversified economy. Littleton used to rely heavily on manufacturing, but by the 1970s, much of that history had faded away, and with it, hundreds of jobs. So the town decided to invest in a new industrial park a couple minutes' drive from Main Street. Greg Eastman is president of the Littleton Industrial Development Corporation, and he says it's saved them.
We think the industrial park, as it's grown through the mid-70s to today, has been the economic backbone of our local economy.
Eastman says the industrial park was huge for Littleton in two ways. It opened up a variety of different jobs, and he says it led to growth all over the Littleton area. It revived Main Street, increased tourism, and that created more jobs downtown, which meant demand for big box stores like Walmart and Home Depot, and so on and so on. So if there were a blueprint for other New Hampshire towns that want to follow in the Littleton area footsteps, it would at least include a strong community, access to activities, it would be affordable, and have a diversified economy. But there's something else I learned while reporting this story. Sometimes 20 or 30-somethings move home because of entirely different factors. Nick Starella has lived in New York and Los Angeles, but recently he decided he was done with the city lifestyle. If that Starella name is familiar, that's because Nick is Joel Starella's cousin, remember with the 80s and 90s store. Nick grew up in Bethlehem.
I moved back because I was looking for somewhere to move,
really.
That wasn't a hectic city, and it didn't. This just kind of came almost like on a whim, because it was zero stress. If I didn't want to stay, I could just leave.
Starella took over the family antique shop and updated it with apothecary products like pine-scented candles and beard oil. It's an Instagrammer's dream.
You can make more money probably doing this somewhere else, I think, but maybe wouldn't have as much free time. So to me, that's not the most important thing, money right now. Time is more important.
More time means more visits from his wife and daughter, who you can hear in the background. When his cousin Joel decided to move back to New Hampshire, it was in part because he watched his cousin Nick take the leap back home and figured he could succeed too. So family bonds, more free time, or a desire to just get up and move for a different speed of life, sometimes the factors that get a 20 or 30-something to move to New Hampshire, they're things that no chamber of commerce or city official can control. For NHPR News, I'm Lauren Chulgin.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. At the beginning of the month, an art space and music venue in Littleton, New Hampshire, hosted a pair of funky jam band style collectives, including Corduroy Groove, based in sunny San Francisco. And later this month, just after Valentine's Day, a mini festival called the Heartbreakers Ball. Featuring a lineup of bands including Time Out Timmy, They Hate Us, and Frenzy of Tongs from Providence, Rhode Island. Heard here playing their song, Doctor Who. That is just a sampling of the kind of stuff that you might find at the loading dock. It's a bring-your-own-beer, projector-screen, behind-the-stage sort of affair, named for the fact that the space is a literal loading dock. Co-founder Jason Torres says the space is helping to make Littleton a little weirder and a little more interesting. Jason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
How did the loading dock get started?
I was working at an art gallery called Bad Art with John Stroker, who owns the gallery. And Bad Art, coincidentally, was just below the loading dock. And he alerted me to the availability of this unknown space with an unknown way of getting in that became available. Once I walked in there, I immediately was impressed with the size and the overall strange shape of the loading dock.
So is that how people get in? They sort of like ramp up on the loading dock?
Yeah, the entrance is an actual loading dock, and there's a door to the side of that, and that enters into my space. Our space used to be the storeroom for the Courier newspaper.
Hmm. So what do? You throw in like a PA system and a microphone and a bar, and there you have it?
Just about. Well, when I first got in there, first we had to do was to change out the windows. We had old, boarded up, single-pane leaded windows that needed to be replaced, and the landlord was nice enough to replace them with nice modern windows. So we had really good natural light. And my initial idea was that I would turn that space into my art studio and possibly a maker space. And then local business, Northern Lights Music, they had a sale on PAs. And they had a bunch of microphones that they threw into the deal. And I decided to jump on it and, you know, got a PA system and a mixing board and a couple of microphones. And we started rehearsing bands in that space. First, it was bands that I was in. And then other people started to gain interest and started rehearsing there as well.
So you've got this music venue. How do people, you know, bands who are touring find out about it? I mean, Littleton is not really on the touring circuit.
This was the thing that really kind of broke it all open, was my cousin, Mario Santana, no relation to
Carlos
Santana. he told me about this website called dodiy.org. And what it is a listing of DIY venues in all 50 states. And so I wrote to the guy that runs the website, which is a super simple, basic HTML website. And he posted the loading dock on there. We were one of two places in New Hampshire. And within approximately a week and a half to 2 weeks, I got an inquiry from my first band.
So your band comes. What's the setup like inside? Are, you know, chairs, food?
It's a pretty flexible space. We host art events as well as storytelling, open mics. So we try not to stick with one thing or the other, but try and really surface all of the arts, not just music.
Well, I wonder about that. You know, do people just show up for something because they know you're going to put on something interesting? Have you? How do you get people in Littleton to bundle up and come on out to the loading dock?
That is the trick. It's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, this community is so tight-knit, and everybody really knows everyone else. And, you know, word of mouth plays a huge role in that. You know, I have a lot of volunteers that help out at the loading dock. It's something that I couldn't do on my own. They really help spread the word, both on Facebook. Facebook is really big. Posters really help. A lot of times, I see people on the street, and I tell them.
What kind of music are people into up there in Littleton?
There's a lot. I mean, you know, predominantly it's blues and bluegrass, and you know, jam bands are still really strong up around this area. But there's also a really vibrant punk scene that I really didn't know about until I started the loading dock, and they sort of came to me and wanted to put on shows. You know, the folks in Time Out Timmy, Tim and Amelia Height, they're both married. They live in Lisbon. They tour a ton. They've really grown out of, you know, the loading dock scene and have moved on and are touring all around New England and into New York City. They even went down to South by Southwest last year. One thing that's really important to me and was instrumental in my young adult life was having all ages shows that you can go and check out. And I think it's a really important experience to be able to see live music in an intimate setting where, you know, people are really doing what they love.
I'm wondering about how the town has reacted. You've got high school age kids, you've got punk bands. A lot of different kinds of traffic, maybe than the town is used to. So how are your neighbors responding and the town?
That's a good question. You know, it's mixed. There's a lot of folks that are super happy about it and, you know, very welcoming. And then, you know, there's maybe a population of folks that are not necessarily as enthusiastic. You know, I've been warned by the local police, the Littleton police, that they are keeping an eye on me. They're super nice about it. We actually have the Littleton police. One of the officers comes in almost every show and, you know, just kind of checks it out. He's a music fan and a musician. And he pops in and, you know, sees what we have going on. For the most part, everybody's super supportive. You know, the thing that I think confuses people is that we don't serve alcohol. We don't have food. You can bring your own beverages in. You know, sometimes our admission fee is by donation. And we're also not a nonprofit either. So we don't really neatly fit into something that folks expect. But I kind of like that. And I kind of feel like it's an important thing for, you know, the area to have something that is a little bit, you know, unusual.
I'm curious, how do you see Littleton changing?
Well, you know, it's a funny question. You know, it's a little unknown at right now. You know, we're at that pivotal point where things can go so many different directions. There's a lot of, there are actually a lot of buildings for sale in Littleton. There's a lot of change happening. And there's also a lot of younger folks that are moving in. I think one of the things that really is helping Littleton right now is that rents are low, relatively speaking. You know, it's attainable. If you want to start a business, you can try something a little risky, like what I'm doing, or, you know, like what other folks are doing in town, where it's not cookie cutter. It's, let's try something weird. Let's try something different and, you know, see if it works. There's a little bit of a sense of impermanence to thinking that way. But, you know, you never know. You might hit on a need in the community that will really take off and blossom.
Jason Torres, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, no problem.
Jason Torres, co-founder of The Loading Dock in Littleton, New Hampshire. The Heartbreakers Ball, featuring The Frenzy of Tongs, They Hate Us, and Littleton Natives' Time Out Timmy, is on Saturday, February 17th. Here's another group called The Skinks that we're listening to now. They're formerly known as Thumb Dog. Check it out. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. When Amy Jenkins was getting ready to move from Brooklyn to New Hampshire, she paused in front of a mirror with her camera.
April 9th, 2000. Almost 34. Everything's changing, but it's good. A little scary. That's okay.
The artist and filmmaker Amy Jenkins documents everything: her wedding, a positive pregnancy test, a new baby. But in a new documentary, she follows the devastating process of losing her mother and sister to cancer, and her brother's cancer diagnosis soon after. Her film Instructions on Parting is making its world premiere at the Museum of Modern Art this month as part of MoMA's Doc Fortnite Film Festival. And Amy's joining us now in the studio. Amy Jenkins, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I gotta say, after watching the film, so sorry for your loss. Losses.
Thank you for saying so.
You're an artist and filmmaker. This is a cinema verite film. What does that mean exactly?
It means that while I was filming, I was observing, and it was unfolding in front of me without any particular direction or my asking my family members to behave in any particular way.
So true life.
Mm-hmm.
Have you always documented your life?
I have, since a very young child, always seemed to have a camera or a journal or something that was documenting my present situation.
In the film, the family gathers around at one point to watch a slideshow. And there's mom and dad, you know, watching this new baby Linda appears, then Craig, then you, Amy, as children in their awkward teenage years, eventually weddings, grandkids. Let's hear just a clip of that.
Ellen's sucking in her stomach there.
She's proud of her weight.
Oh, okay. Ellen's night blooming cactus.
I think I remember this night.
It was so wonderful. It only bloomed once a season.
And only at night?
Only at night. Just lucky to catch it.
And then
so
the next day, Mom?
The next day, they die. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, you woke us up, and we smelled the wonderful smell.
It had to be real big.
Okay, guys.
Those are great. I haven't seen a lot of those.
You know, watching that made me think of how little people's lives used to be photographed. Now there's so much material. Can it feel overwhelming to you?
It's interesting how much technology has changed and how having a camera in everybody's back pocket now means that we've all become documentarians. This film, the footage was created long before everybody had an iPhone in their pocket. Actually, one of the reasons why I was a documentarian from a young age was because I was upset with my dad because he only had about 3 or 4 pictures of me from birth to age 16.
The third child problem.
Yes, exactly.
So now everybody does have an iPhone in their pocket. And one of the things that struck me is that the quality of iPhones are so good. Like even watching a film that you began in the 2000s, it looks dated.
It's true. Although one thing that I loved about this little camera I had was that it felt like an extension of my body. And despite the fact that the filming was over 6 years and technology began to change in that time period, I chose to continue filming with this particular small, what's now called SD camera, standard definition. And when we went to edit and produce the film, we decided to keep the square format and to keep the very raw look of the video because it does refer very specifically to that time period.
So with all this footage that you took, you put together this story, this film, and early on, just after finding out that you were pregnant, you get news that your mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer, your sister with stage 4 ovarian cancer, and you have this beautiful new baby, coinciding with several trips back out west to Salt Lake City or near Salt Lake City to see your family. So you're thrust into this new role as a mom and a caregiver and caring for your family. What was going on for you?
It was a time where all of my priorities became very focused on the people around me and day-to-day living. In that respect, it was oddly an opportunity to really hunker down and be with the people that I loved. It was also very much about living in the present. I had a fairly active career as a visual artist at that point in New York City, and I made the choice to postpone some exhibitions, and I put all of my time and effort into really just being with my family. And that I have zero regrets about. It was a beautiful opportunity to be with them.
And we see throughout the kind of cycle of life, you know, taking place. We have the beautiful shots of your pregnant belly, you know, full of youth and fecundity and, you know, the natural world. We see robin's eggs laid and then later hatching and a tree taken down in front of your home. So time is moving on. Was there a comfort in that for you?
A lot of the nature footage I was filming at the same time that my family members were ill, it was a sort of coping mechanism to go out in my yard and to observe nature as it was progressing. And in a way, it was also a search for a sort of metaphorical relationship between what was around me in nature in my yard in New Hampshire and what was happening with my family in Utah.
Well, you let us in and watch as your family, your sister Linda, is getting weaker. You know, she's diminished. Her walking is slower. She's not eating. And she said, I'm choosing not to think about cancer all the time. I'm going back to work. Your mom, she won't even talk about the diagnosis. And maybe I get a sense that she's focused on her daughter, you know, that's where she's shifted things. But there's a conversation that you have when you're leaving Salt Lake City, when Linda is really looking pretty, pretty thin. Let's hear a little clip of that.
You said you wanted to ask me something.
Well,
you know,
God.
Well, but I'm scared that I might leave and, you know, what if this is the last time I see you?
Oh, I don't think so.
I mean, it scares me. And what's going to happen if I'm away and I can't get here in time? And I guess I'm wondering if there's any small possibility that it's the last time I see you. You know, is there anything that you want to tell me, or is there anything I should tell you, or, you know, I mean, so little happens with words. Oh, somebody's here. Should I go get it?
Sure.
Okay.
It's a scene from Instructions on Parting by my guest, the filmmaker and artist, Amy Jenkins. Amy, was that the last time you saw your sister?
No, I did have the opportunity to see her a number of times more. It was ironic because, and this happens a number of times in the film, when those moments to have those big conversations seem to be arriving, we were oftentimes interrupted by, like in that scene, a knock on the door, or the conversation would turn to something else. And I think what I realized was that there isn't always one big conversation. It's a series of many small moments. And having those at times that you don't expect and that you can't necessarily prepare for.
It speaks to how difficult it is to talk about death, even when it's right in front of you.
Mm.
But there is this beautiful sequence that you shot with your sister in front of a black screen or background. And it's from the back. Her head is shaven. Your hands are touching her, you know, in a prayer position first, but then just touching her back. And it is so intimate, so tender. What inspired that shot?
Originally, as an artist, I was thinking about visual ways to relate to my family. At that time, I did not consider myself a filmmaker. I was more of a visual artist. And so I asked each of my family members to let me film them in what I considered sort of cancer portraits, with my hands touching their scars and expressing my love for them visually with my hands and their bodies. And that's what I imagined to be my artwork. Later, they seemed so intimate to me that I didn't know how to work with them as images, and so I put them away. And actually, all of the footage I filmed had originally been for personal reasons, without the intention of making a film to show the public. But after many years of this material sitting in a box, I realized that it was incredibly potent. And so I decided to take the box out and look at what was on all of the tapes and see what I could make of it. And initially, I didn't think that the landscape footage and the home movies and the cancer portraits, which were three very distinct styles of filming, would relate to one another. But as I watched further and further, I realized that the three really did belong together. And that's how this film was realized.
And it is, I have to say, a really extraordinary part of it. It makes me think of how we in general kind of shrink from illness. And we have those extraordinary, you know, like beautiful, and they feel like art shots. And then we have the day-to-day, which is so moving and so powerful to watch because it's so real. There's a bit where your sister has passed, your mother passes very suddenly, your brother is diagnosed, and he's getting sick. And here's a little bit from the film where you're asking him if you can do something for him.
Hey, Craig.
Yeah?
I was going to swing by your apartment and get your printer manual. Is there anything you want me to pick up for you in your apartment? That you can think of? Is there anything you need?
You can get a pillow off the couch there.
Okay.
In this scene, you walk in and you know, you've got your camera and Craig just sort of turns his back and walks away. There are times that I felt watching this a little uncomfortable for your family. You know, something so intimate and private. And did anyone in the family ever say to you, just, you know, Amy, put away the camera. I don't want this on film.
My family was remarkably comfortable with me with a camera, perhaps because I seemed to have one around my entire life.
Your mom says that at the wedding, you know, always with the camera kind
yeah.
of thing.
They were incredibly open. However, my mother being, you know, a woman from the 1940s and 50s was very particular about wanting to look a certain way if I had my camera out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few times in the film where she says, you know, Amy, I don't want my picture taken. And I actually chose to leave those moments in the film where she says to me to put the camera away, partly because it showed our relationship, but also because I didn't want to shy away from the fact that it was important to acknowledge the existence of the camera and those awkward, difficult moments.
It's almost like a family slideshow. These, you know, pictures, these images are something that you can go back to over and over again. Are they something that you will show to the now 15-year-old who was a little baby in the film?
Absolutely. The film really does capture my family, but in particular, it captures my firstborn in all of those key moments of learning to crawl, learning to walk, first words, and really finding their personhood. And that's an important element in the film because as my firstborn was coming into their personhood, my other family members were beginning to let go of their place here on Earth.
And the film is called Instructions on Parting. Did you learn how to do it? I mean, do you have instructions for us?
Well, I chose to call it Instructions on Parting because when I began the process of editing it into a film, I was really looking for those instructions myself. People have asked me, you know, wasn't it sad? Wasn't it difficult to make this film? And there were certainly moments that were difficult, but it was also a real joy to be able to sit with the footage of my family and to feel like I was spending time with these people who are no longer here. And so as far as learning how to part, what I learned was that I don't have to part. My joy in these people still exists, and I can continue to love them. I've just let go of their presence in my daily life.
Well, Amy Jenkins, thank you so much for sharing this story for us. It was just extraordinarily moving.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Amy Jenkins there, producer, director, and editor of Instructions on Parting. The film makes its world premiere at the Museum of Modern Art Doc Fortnite Film Festival in New York City on February 16th. There's a link to watch the trailer and find more on the film and the opening at MoMA at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about The Balance. That's NHBR's ongoing series on the cost of living in New Hampshire. Well, one of the subjects we're looking to cover is the commute. More than 100,000 Granite Staters leave the state for work, like Jeff Warner, who's been doing it for more than two decades.
Concord to Boston, to Dover to Boston, Newburyport to Boston, Plastow to Boston, Chester to Boston.
Jeff works in masonry as a superintendent for huge construction projects, the kind you don't see much of in New Hampshire, so he's an old hand at crossing the border. We asked him to share a little bit of his commuting story.
You know, I mean, 30 years ago, you could leave Concord, New Hampshire at 6 in the morning. You could be in Boston Park by pretty close to 7 o'clock. It's gotten to be now where you've got to leave at literally 4 or 5 in the morning in order to safely, achieve a less than 2-hour commute. You know, it gives you time to think. Which is, I think, you decompress a lot. Decompress, and then if you didn't get it the first decompression, you could do it 3 or 4 more times. God knows you got plenty of time. I think my worst commute ever was Friday night. We got out of work, you know, late. It took me 5.5 hours to get back to Concord, New Hampshire. So that would go down as markedly the worst commute that I ever had.
That's just a little bit of Jeff Warner's life on the road. We would like to hear your commuting story. How has your commute improved or diminished your quality of life? how do you make a cost-benefit analysis when it comes to your commute? Do you think you have the craziest commute of anybody in New Hampshire? Let us know. Record a voice memo with your story and mail it to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 603-223-2431. That's 603-223-2431. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This episode was produced by Taylor Quimby with Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, Ben Henry, and Justine Paradise. This week, we welcomed our brand new executive producer, Erica Janik, to the team. Maureen McMurray is director of Evaluating India Pale Ales. Music today from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Corduroy Groove, Frenzy of Tongs, Experimental Forest, Time Out Timmy, The Skinks, and Revolution Void. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back next week with an exploration of the origins of the New Hampshire sacred cow, the entrenched opposition to a sales or income tax. You can catch that story by word of mouth next Saturday at 11, right here on NHPR or at nhpr.org.